Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, my friends. Did you ever almost miss something important because you got involved in a phone call? I was just talking with somebody about a legal case, and I suddenly realized it was showtime. I almost was late for the first time in my life for my wonderful audience of the leading folks in the world talking about psychiatric drugs, mental health, being critical of drugs and shock and lobotomies and drug companies and so on. So here I am, a little breathless. Everything looks good right now. And we're going to have an interesting show today. Ryan, are you there?
I am, yes.
Okay, well, good. I wasn't sure if I was here. That was the that was my main problem today, is Peter Breggin there? And he almost wasn't. You know, I live such an interesting life, folks. I get calls every single day from distressed people around the world. I can't answer the vast majority of them. Each one deserves hours. And I have to pick and choose who I think I can help or do the most good for. And often there are people who have legal cases. But often there are people that, you know, just have a great deal of trouble. And I'm just one person. I'm not an institute with lots of people working with me. It's me and then lots of help from my wife, Ginger. But she's got lots of other activities that she does. So for those of you who have tried to call me and I haven't answered, who tried to email me and you have heard from my wife, or just gotten an automated, we'll call you if we think we can help. I apologize, but that is the nature of existence here in the world of Peter and Ginger. We can't even begin to touch all the folks who call us, and I wish we could give our help to. And when I do help, I put my heart into it. I was just trying to figure out whether I could help someone. And I was in the process of telling him probably not after all this time. And it was not comfortable. I nearly missed my show. My guest today is Ryan Melton, R-Y-A-N-M-E-L-T-O-N. He's a PhD. And Ryan is the clinical director of a center that looks into and implements early interventions. The official name is clinical director of EASA Center for Excellence. He works out of Portland State University. And he's also on the faculty at Oregon State. He can explain any of the ins and outs of that are necessary. He's published papers with other people and textbook chapters on early interventions with psychosis, and he presents at conferences. And he also has a small private practice where he supervises mental health clinicians for licensure in Oregon, and he provides training in the diagnosis and assessment and current evidence-based mental health, a lot for early interventions. He's a PhD in the arena of counseling, which is the most friendly arena probably to my work. Most of the teaching I've done has been in graduate schools of counseling, including Johns Hopkins, and then for many years up here, SUNY Oswego, in the Department of Counseling, University of Maryland, and so on. The work that Ryan Melton is doing is cutting edge. You'll see that it's not quite as cutting as I would like at times, but frankly, there isn't any way to work in the establishment and to be as cutting edge as I would like people to be. It just can't be done. And so I'm going to appreciate that limitation that Ryan's working within and look at both sides. Look at what he is doing, and then along the way, from my viewpoint, what more he could be doing. And I'll start in the beginning, not for discussion, but just because I know a lot of my listeners will be alert to this, and that is there are hazards in early intervention programs for psychosis. There are huge hazards of psychiatry, diagnosing and drugging people. And yet the best programs, if you look at Open Dialogue in Finland, are fairly early interventions. They're not exactly, I think, what Ryan Melton is doing with his program, where they probably look at pre-psychosis. We'll talk about that. But certainly early intervention with people who are having psychotic breaks when they're teenagers and so on is the best way to go. And I've had success in my practice seeing people who just manage to find their way to me instead of a mental hospital, or come out of a mental hospital and find their way to me. So with that introduction about the complexities, I really warmly welcome Ryan Melton to the program. You can respond to what I'm saying, or just explain what you're doing, how you got into it, Ryan, wherever you want to begin.
Okay. Well, thank you, Peter. Again, I really appreciate the opportunity to come on the air and talk to you and to share information about our program and engage in a discussion and on what we feel we're doing well and what we need to continue to learn and explore. So again, I appreciate that opportunity. So my name is Ryan Melton. I'm the clinical director for the ESA Center for Excellence, and that is out of Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. ESA, explain what that stands for. ESA is an acronym for our program, which is Early Assessment and Support Alliance. The mission of ESA is to identify young people somewhere in between the ages of 15 to 25, give or take, who are experiencing early or first episode symptoms of major psychotic disorders. And when I talk about major psychotic disorders, as I'm sure your listeners may be aware, I'm referring to schizophrenia-related disorders. The idea with ESA, and like most early psychosis programs around the country and around the world, are that if we can intervene early in this condition, we can curb some of the biological, psychological, social, and I believe even cultural consequences of conditions like schizophrenia and maybe even bipolar disorder like that. And we do this by, one, identifying early. So we try to get our message out to the communities in Oregon, letting the communities know what the early symptoms of psychosis are and how to refer to our programs. And we try to make that referral process as quickly and as easy as possible. Although the Center for Excellence where I work is in Portland, ESA has programs in almost all counties in Oregon. So we actually do have funding for all programs, and some programs certainly are still developing, but we have programs in almost all counties within the state of Oregon. So even if you lived in rural Oregon or southern Oregon, miles and miles away from Portland, Oregon, there is an ESA program there to serve you or your family member should they be experiencing the early symptoms. Once we get that call, we have a team of trained staff who are trained in our philosophy and our model that will outreach to the individual. The individual never has to come to our office if they choose not to, or one of our many offices across the state. We can meet them in their homes. We can meet them in a coffee shop. We can meet them wherever they would be comfortable. We certainly do recognize that at times, I think what you referred to, Peter, as the establishment comes with some stigma and some potential identity curbing, which we certainly want to avoid. So if people are uncomfortable or not interested in coming to one of our clinics, we will certainly meet them wherever they're at. And again, the goal really is just to keep young people on their normal life path so they're not burdened by this potential disease or condition. We emphasize quite a bit what a young person would be interested in. We focus more on work goals, school goals, relationship goals, family goals, and less on you have this underlying biochemical disorder that we need to treat by rebalancing your neurotransmitters. That's not a message that we would want to give to a young person. We really want to focus on whatever their goals are and kind of keep them going. Our teams are made up of counselors, our social workers, people who support are especially trained in helping people get through their educational programs, whether that be high school or college, people who are trained in finding and supporting individuals in obtaining and maintaining employment. We have occupational therapists that will help us focus on potentially sensory issues and cognitive issues that are sometimes present with these conditions. We have psychiatry that will provide medicines to those who are interested and may need those. And then we have peer support, so individuals with lived experience who can help us, you know, the professionals, kind of engage and understand what, you know, the participants in our program are experiencing at a level that we as professionals may not be able to understand. And so that's another big element of our program. So in short, what ESA is trying to do is identify symptoms as early as we possibly can. The idea being if you catch conditions early, the better the outcome, and I think that's been well established within the literature. And then so people can kind of move on in their normal life path and not get caught up in this system. And we do that by having a set of well-trained professionals of multiple disciplines with multiple emphasis to make sure that we meet whatever need that young person is having at the time that they're introduced to us. We feel very privileged is that this would be a free program to people. I think the state of Oregon has been really committed to this process and by taking almost a public health approach so that this isn't a payer-based system. You don't have to be on a Medicaid system. You don't have to have private insurance. You don't have to have the money to pay for the services. If you have the symptoms that we're concerned about, then you will get all of those services free of charge. We certainly would bill if there were opportunities to do so, but we also recognize that a lot of our interventions are outside of what the system normally pays for. I mean, most insurance companies don't pay for helping people find jobs, for example, or don't pay for peer support, someone with shared experience, to talk with someone who's have a similar experience. Those things generally aren't covered by standard medical insurances. So we cover all things that would not otherwise be covered in our practices. What else can I tell you, Peter?
What's the source of funding for the national organization?
So we're a state organization, ESA is. There are other organizations that exist around the country, but our funding is mostly from our federal block grant funding. Is where majority of our funding come from. We certainly have some other forms of funding through some grants, and we certainly will bill insurance where we can. We definitely are.
What I'm not sure about is ESA is a concept. Again, folks, spelled capital letters EASA, mm-hmm. And Ryan Melton is from the ESA Center for Excellence. at Portland State University and covers the whole of Oregon. Now, the concept of ESA has an origin outside of your work. I didn't ever ask you, where does that come from, that concept, and do we have any idea who funds that?
The concept of early psychosis, you know, is not a new concept. I think it's now we're all probably pushing, I don't know, maybe 20 plus years of work. ESA has existed since 2001. We initially modeled ourselves after a program called EPIC in Melbourne, Australia. That was Patrick McGorry's program. So that when we first started, that we attempted to try to be a hybrid of that model. Since then, we've definitely focused our efforts to be much more regional, focused on the culture of Oregon, focused much more on peer integrated services, more holistic services since then. And I am unaware who funds some of the national programs.
Okay. Tell us what the early symptoms are. That's going to be a thorny and interesting
sure.
Issue. So do you have a list of early symptoms?
We do. We do have our brochures, and you know, we definitely try. One of the crux of our program is to get the word out so people can recognize whether they're experiencing these symptoms in themselves, or a family member recognizes them, or a physician recognizes them, or a private practice counselor recognizes them, or a coach recognizes them, teacher recognizes them. Referrals for our program can come from anywhere. They don't need to come from a doctor or anything like that. So our brochures will, and our website lists several of our early symptoms, and those include, and I won't go through them all, I'll just highlight a few. You know, maybe it's social withdrawal and isolating from your friends and families for some unexplained reasons, dramatic changes in sleep, making statements that are maybe feel bizarre, unusual when thinking about what's around them. We look for changes in three primary areas, and those areas are around performance, behavior, and perceptual changes. So some of the changes that we might see in performance is that the individual's starting to experience trouble reading or understanding complex sentences, or trouble speaking or understanding what other people are saying, or becoming more easily confused. Maybe an academic drop or attendance drop for just no explained reason, at least that we can see on the outside. Maybe fears that are starting to develop that seem out of sorts or inconsistent with what their experiences appear to be. Decline in hygiene, incoherent or unusual writing, maybe heightened sensitivity to light, sound, smells, touch, making statements like, it feels like my mind is playing tricks on me, maybe experiencing hearing something that other people can't hear, but recognizing that that's an unusual experience for them anyway. And reporting visual changes, maybe colors feel more intense. There's distortions in their visual field. And maybe getting a sense that somebody's trying to read their mind or put thoughts into their head at a very early stage, which are all very kind of uncomfortable to them. Those are those early signs.
Do you get many cases of drug abuse that could overlap with that? That's more just curiosity. Does that happen much?
Oh, sure. I mean, we, as you may or may not be aware, I mean, Oregon is a state where marijuana is legal. And so
marijuana could do every one of those things, Steve.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're 100% correct. So, yeah, absolutely. We get referrals of individuals who have been using substances that may be causing or perpetuating some of these symptoms. So we take the A in our name very seriously, that assessment piece. So really trying to determine where these changes and these experiences may be coming from. You know, because I think somebody who's experiencing these symptoms due to, say, marijuana use, you know, our message to them could be very different and treatment could be very different than somebody whose experiences don't appear to be coming from a substance. So we really try to assess out the difference there. to the extent that we can, and certainly that's not a perfect science, as you're aware.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And what about the concept of schizophrenia, which you probably know is not a concept I much care for, though clearly people do get psychotic, that is, they lose touch with what we consider reality. Is that an important concept in your work? Do you have a biological basis for thinking about it, or do you just not deal with that?
Sure. That's a really great question. And so I think we look at it at a little bit slightly different angles. One, it's not an important concept for the individual. The concept, you know, that we're trying to try to help individuals for whatever they're experiencing and whatever explanatory model they have. You know, we're not certainly not going to force a diagnostic label like schizophrenia on them. We certainly use that term to then talk with other professionals.
If you refer them to a psychiatrist, they'll use it, though, right?
Not all of our psychiatrists. No, not necessarily. We have several of our psychiatric prescribers who don't use that term.
Really?
Yeah, they may use a term like, you know, extreme states. They may use a term like unusual experiences that other people aren't experiencing, you know, experiences that are causing you some difficulties.
Ryan, that sounds almost too good to believe here in the United States that there are many practicing psychiatrists like that. I mean, that's both exciting and I'm a little skeptical, but you really do have psychiatrists that take that approach to people who are having those symptoms.
Yes, we have the pleasure of working psychiatrists that will take that approach. Now, you know, to your point, I mean, do all of our psychiatrists take that? Maybe not. I mean, we sometimes work within a medical system. We have psychiatrists that come and go and we can't get to them or train them quickly enough. So certainly that's not perfect, but we have some of our longer standing psychiatric prescribers certainly would take that approach. I mean, they're really more about engaging the individual and focusing on treating whatever their concept of the challenge is. And so that's how that level of treatment is used. And again, my disclaimer is that I'm not a psychiatric provider, so I don't get the opportunity to sit in every single session, but I can speak to some of the experiences that I've had.
I'd asked you during our conversation if you had any idea how many. You estimated about 400 people had been through the program so far, or were in it.
When I was able to pull our data from last year, we had actually 666 individuals served in 2016. And with 870 referred, it looks like. There's some missing numbers there, so it's going to be slightly higher than that, but that's what I was able to pull
up. Could you get any idea of how many were given drugs at some point, or what kind of drugs or anything like that?
Yeah, our data is, we're in a transition process right now, and one thing we haven't historically collected, which we're going to be collecting in the future, actually thanks to some influence by groups like yours and some of your ideas, we had only collected information on whether or not people were taking medicines or not. We didn't actually get in breakdown classes or anything like that. So what we don't know is like what percentage we're taking antipsychotics versus anti-anxiety versus antidepressants. So that's an area of growth for us that we're going to be looking at for future data collection.
But you had some percentages on just medicine?
Yeah, we had some percentages. Our last data report, which again, we're in a process of transitioning, so terrible timing for this call on a data question because I don't have access to it at the moment. About 55% or so were taking some form of medicine, but I don't know the class.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to get a breakdown. We could have you back in the future and to talk more about the breakdowns of meds and other issues and any progress you're making. What you said implied that I've had some influence in some way on the direction you're taking, and as well as other people. Mm-hmm. You were telling me when we were talking that you'd actually been assigned one of my books during your training.
Yeah, I think I was fortunate and very early on in my career. In fact, I think it was my junior or senior year of undergraduate in my abnormal psych class where one of the assigned texts was talking back to Prozac. You know, so I got to see, you know, kind of, I think that the professor was trying to do a nice job, which I now mimic myself as a professor, to kind of balance, you know, different ideas in psychology and psychiatry that, you know, so. So that was a very early influence, and that's kind of carried on throughout my career. And certainly, I have read Bob Whitaker's texts, and you know, and been educated in that way, and have attended many of his presentations, and have actually had the opportunity to present alongside him. And so So we certainly, I think, with mental health, there is no simple answer to human experience, and I think understanding multiple lenses and multiple ideas is essential. Both, yeah.
I think it's great that you're doing that with Bob. Has he written up your program anywhere?
He has mentioned it in some of his maybe blogs or something like that. And I know we presented together several years ago at a conference in the Portland area, and he's attended. And I know he's attended some of my talks and vice versa.
Yeah, that's really great. You're having all those all those interactions. Mm-hmm. Have you set up a? I would think you have, because I know it's key to you. Assessment programs. How are your assessment programs going?
Our assessment programs. Can you say more about your question?
Yeah, I mean. Are you able to assess to any degree your success at this point?
Yeah, I mean, we do take, the data that we collect data quarterly, and some of the outcomes that we explore are, you know, vocational outcomes, educational outcomes, individuals applying for disability, engagement with family, you know, those type of functional outcomes. And so then those certainly vary from quarter to quarter, but we've seen as high as 80% of our participants involved in educational and vocational programs. So that ranges, however, that's our high end. We've seen lower, as low as 60, so certainly it varies from time to time. So we see high levels of involvement and engagement with family members are important people in one's life. So trying to keep families or other important social supports intact. So those can be up as high as 90%, you know, approximately only about 20-25% individuals applying for disability. Those are, we feel positive about those, you know, we also see our program as very iterative, and we're always learning, and we're always looking to see how we can improve. And I think one thing that we really try to do is to not get stuck on the process and really focus on outcomes and try and determine what works. And if what we're doing doesn't work, then we make a change. And certainly our program looks quite different than it did in 2001, for sure.
Do you do any kind of a before and after assessment?
We do. Again, a lot of it's, yeah, we will accept the outcomes that I just...
I know that's, I know it's, by the way, very easy for me to ask the questions, but mm-hmm. doing those things is very, very difficult. I know that.
Yeah,
so go ahead.
It is. It is, since we're not necessarily even a research facility. We're community-based, so it, in a lot of ways it is challenged to do some of the levels of research that, you know, that some of our partner programs have done around the country. But I also, in some ways, see that as a strength of ours, because we get to work with people in the community. We'll work with people whether they sign up for our research project or not. You know, I mean, one of the flaws in research, as you're aware, is that these are people that have signed up and are willing. And, you know, and we will work with individuals who, you know, sometimes where maybe there is active drug use, for example. Maybe there is where the symptoms may be impairing the individual's ability to the point where they really are struggling and maybe even engaging in dangerous behaviors. And so we're right there, you know, so that's, you know, that's one.
Do you have an assessment that 25% end up on disability?
Are applying for it. We don't know. Yeah.
We're applying for it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then you don't have a history of that. How about how many get end up going through a psychiatric hospitalization? Do you have any data on that?
Yeah, we do. We collect it about 3 months prior to, so we try to go back at least 3 months prior to enrollment. And we actually have a pretty high percentage of people that are psychiatrically hospitalized. And again, I wish I had the data in front of me, but it's around half of people are psychiatrically hospitalized prior to entering our program. And that, of course, well, drops significantly once enrolled in the program down to around 10%, kind of over the course of time in our program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be hard to put together a good assessment, obviously. Have you published anything in the way of your program?
Most of what we published is, you know, a model of descriptions of our models. Like we've written a textbook chapter and what we do, and I'm working on another textbook chapter on using feedback-informed treatment with, you know, young people with psychosis. And we've published in some journals, mostly descriptors with some of the percentages that I just listed for you. But what we haven't done is really sophisticated randomized controlled trials. And that's just been a kind of a challenge, kind of working in community settings.
Yeah. I mean, it's really going to have to be more just how do individuals do, how many of them
right.
go here, there, and
exactly.
how many
that's
people can be rated as successfully helped
yeah.
in some way without a control.
Right. Right. Yes. And that's
most
certainly,
likely.
A potential research weakness, but in some ways I kind of view it as, well, we're ethically, we feel we should, you know, I don't know if it's ethically to withhold certain services from people. So it's a balance that we face for sure.
Do you get any flack from the psychiatric community or any community?
Do we get flack? And certainly we've experienced some flack around of communities that feel that we're too intensive, that, you know, because we ask for, I guess maybe I think you talked about just the kind of standard care where it's really high caseloads, and, you know, some of our programs push back because we demand really low caseloads, and we demand that our clinicians and programs have time to practice our fidelity. So we get some pushback there. Is it, are we too rich? Are we doing too much? We get some of that. You know, certainly some of the anti-psychiatry groups have challenged us in the same way that you've challenged. Is like, are you identifying people too early that you may be unintentionally or maybe intentionally labeling them as having psychiatric conditions? Are you starting people on meds that may not be necessary? You know, certainly we've heard those challenges, and I think we're open to those challenges, and we're open to having discussions with those groups on what we're doing and what we think is helpful and what we can learn that maybe isn't. And I think that's what really unique. I think we really have a growth mindset when it comes to our work.
You're certainly in a state that has a number of very powerful activists over the years.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, we are.
Have you actually met with them or held any conferences with them or discussions with them?
Yeah, I mean, the conference, and I wish I could remember the name, but the conference that I, you know, where I met with Bob and we kind of had a short co-presentation together was a conference sponsored that I think was heavily sponsored by Mind Freedom, which is one of the activist groups in Oregon.
Yeah, that's what I wondered. It certainly is a big, I don't know big, but it's a very intense and radical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I certainly have met with their members, and some certainly, as you mentioned, have provided criticisms, and others have been supportive. And I think it's just important to have the ongoing dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you got referred here to me through Bob Nickel,
mm-hmm. yeah.
of who's on the board of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Services, is it, or mental health?
Yeah, Excellence in Mental Health Care, I believe.
Mental health care. Yeah. And he's been on my radio show a number of times, Bob, and so is his wife, Gina.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped, he was involved somewhat in the founding of this. You two go back a ways.
We go back a long time, yeah. I mean, Bob was at one point, even my boss, you know, when I was worked for the state of Oregon's mental health division when he was the mental health director. Yeah. And so we got acquainted then, and then we became more acquainted as ESO was being developed in the early stages, and obviously the state of Oregon was very much involved in that as one of our funders. So he's been, you know, yeah, a supporter of our work for many, many years, and had very frank and honest conversations with Bob about the work that we do.
I'm really interested in, but I'm not sure how to pursue this idea that you do have some good psychiatrists, good by my terms, who are actually working with you in terms of avoiding calling people schizophrenic and stuff. You said they were older, coming from the older generation of more psychoanalytically oriented psychiatrists rather than the younger. Did I hear you right on that?
No, I don't know if I said that exactly. One of our psychiatrists does carry some of those foundations, and he's not he's actually fairly new to the field. I know he's involved in training a lot of our psychiatrists. I'm not 100% aware of all of their foundations. I think just seeing at least one of the institutions, I think in Oregon, that trains psychiatric residents has a little more progressive philosophy when it comes to medicine.
It would be interesting for you to follow up on how many psychiatrists you have and what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, I've consulted, as I mentioned to you, I've consulted to two programs that try to deliver community services, and their potential undoing is often the inclusion of the psychiatrist in the team, mm-hmm. because here you are, you're trying to empower a young person to believe in themselves, to have confidence, and not to think, as you're saying, you don't want them to think, you know, that they have biochemical imbalances and that they're schizophrenic and this and that. In come the psychiatrists, and they can undermine everything you've done, sure. A, because mm-hmm. they look more authoritative. That's half the training in psychiatry, is to look authoritative.
Right, of course.
And they got the MD degree, and they wear the suits usually, and they can quickly convince a young person that they are indeed limited by their genetics and their biology, and that they need psychiatric drugs, which are basically very much going to be counterproductive to all the social services that you're providing. So it'd be interesting for you to learn more about that over time.
I'd love to come back and give you some of our numbers and maybe bring even one of our psychiatrists on. I mean, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, that would be very interesting. My own sense of what especially teenagers need, mm-hmm. but really almost everybody who's having a real loss of touch with reality, is a family intervention if the family isn't highly toxic. And many mm-hmm. families are not, and some are,
right.
Very destructive, mm-hmm. and the person's going to do better away from them. But that's usually, if you can salvage anything from mom and dad and brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and so on, and get somebody in there who's in the family to help in a positive, loving, caring, non-judgmental way, it's a tremendously important factor. It's really the most important part for me, of an intervention with young people who are having these kind of crises, is involving the family as the primary health provider, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, helping the family get along and resolve conflicts with the identified patient and look at the whole family situation. Do your folks have much of a family orientation?
Oh yeah, I think it's a key in our model. It's actually one of our core components, is that we must engage the families. I mean, we see this condition, you know, quote unquote, is just as much as a systemic issue as it is an individual issue. You know, that the families play an essential role in, you know, helping the individuals kind of recover or kind of make it through this through their experiences. So it's absolutely, that's actually why we actually track our outcomes around family involvement. And we're, one of our highest outcomes is just this high percentage of family involvement. And we have found, you know, that the majority of our families are not toxic. You know, and certainly there's always examples of that, but that they're actually quite healthy and they're just as confused as the young person is about the experiences that they're having, and they don't know what to do, or, and they're, you know, so yeah, we like to get in and work with them as quickly as possible also. Sometimes they're our first group that we're engaging with, sometimes even before we're engaging with the individual, just to try to give them some education and support.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I know that I think that a lot of the young people who run into that kind of serious difficulty, the problems with the family sometimes were just very early on. Your mom and dad were professionals, overworking, weren't available, the child's being raised by a variety of different sources, doesn't have a consistent parent. And then the parents mature more and become more aware of what their children need and aren't as anxious about success. And they by the time they get to me and their child's 15 or 16, they're very different than they were many years earlier. And they are potentially a very positive influence on the family, on their child, on their children. Some cases not. Some cases you do see almost a kind of malevolence on the part of one or more people in the family. Child abuse is very real.
Yes,
do you deal at all with issues of child abuse?
What was that? I'm sorry.
Do you deal at all with issues of child abuse?
We've had individuals referred to our program that have experienced early child or adverse childhood events like child abuse. Again, the majority of our families, though, I mean, at least as far as we can tell, are very supportive and quite healthy, you know, with a few exceptions. But certainly we know that early adverse childhood events like, you know, child abuse, early sexual abuse, other early physical abuse is a predictor of later diagnosis with psychotic disorders. So certainly it is there, and we do get referred individuals who have experienced that those forms of abuse.
Well,
for sure,
you're getting maybe the method of people contacting you probably comes through the families a lot. Which would mean that they're motivated families.
That's correct. Yes,
which is a good thing, because that's the way you're going to be the most successful. The hardest ways to deal are when we're seeing a very, very wounded, harmed human being who doesn't have a supportive family. That's the worst situation.
Yeah, it does make it very challenging.
Have you all looked at the Finnish program, the Open Dialogue Family Intervention Program out of Lapland that Bob Whitaker's written about, and I have somewhat?
I'm familiar with, I've read journal articles describing the program. There are replication models here in the U.S. I've consulted with their medical directors, and just to kind of see what they're doing and how that's similar to what we're doing, how that's different than what we're doing. So I am familiar with the model. I'm not going to say I'm intimately familiar with the model, but at least on the outset, I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, you really are trying to stay in touch with what's going on around you, and that's really impressive, sir. Can you describe any differences, say, between your model and the Open Dialogue model? The Open Dialogue model, folks, you may have heard of already through me or Bob Whitaker's books or some other place, but it is developed in Finland, and it's only now, after several generations, developing satellites or similar models in the U.S. and in England and elsewhere. It's basically a very early intervention program that brings together a kind of total approach to meeting with and visiting with the family, trying to work in the family setting, trying to sit with the family, usually more than one professional, trying to help the family communicate in a more positive way, and help the family learn about what each other are thinking and feeling. So it's very family-oriented. They use very little drugs. And mostly then they just use something like a benzo for aid with sleep or temporarily with anxiety. Very few of the people end up on antipsychotic drugs. And they've had remarkable success, so much so that in Lapland there's hardly anybody with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, because they all get better within 6 months. And if you get better within 6 months, then technically, according to the good old DSM, you know, you don't get that diagnosis. And they have much less unemployment and much less people on disability. They believe, because they are helping these young people, they usually start young, who know about the program, the families bring them in early on. And you can learn about this from my books, Brain Disabling Treatments and Psychiatry, from Bob Whitaker's books. And you can also just go Google Open Dialogue. What are your differences from them?
You know, and again, I haven't, you know, had the opportunity to consult with the group in Lapland, but consulting with the group in the U.S., we actually found a lot of crossover, you know, into the work that we're doing. As we were describing our models to each other, we were both kind of saying, oh, we're actually doing a lot of the same thing, you know, with that early intervention, trying to engage the family, sitting with the family, looking at families' perceptions, looking at families' experiences, you know, yeah, kind of working with the individuals, focus on their goals and their explanatory models of their experiences. So yeah, a lot of crossover. So we actually felt very like we were very similar, at least to the U.S. Version of open dialogue. You know, looking at some of the just the literature that I've read about the Lapland model. You know, certainly there we. Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, we definitely have a higher rate of medication use than they do. That's absolutely true. That would be undeniable. Maybe that's due to our Western influences. Maybe it's due to the individuals coming into the program. I don't know that. You know, I think we actually had some similar numbers in functional outcomes in terms of employment and people going on disability. So I think we had some similar outcomes there. But yeah, that's what I know. So I think we actually have a lot of crossover, at least with the U.S. version. I don't want to, you know, describe what.
Well, I think the main difference is going to be the medication, and the more you can get away from that, the less harm you'll be doing to folks. Mm-hmm. So you know, I would just urge you to keep working on that aspect of it.
Absolutely.
The people that they get in Lapland are basically acutely psychotic people who would otherwise be labeled schizophrenic on day one, even though you're not supposed to do it for a few months.
Right.
It's supposed to be schizophreniform disorder. I'm not even sure what DSM-5 has done with that. I haven't actually gone in and looked at what DSM-5 is saying about all that. But
basically the same. Yeah, you start with schizophreniform disorder if the symptoms are a month long to, you know, 6 months. After 6 months, you're correct, then we would move forward with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, at least according to the DSM-5.
Yeah. So they're getting very severe problems. So I wouldn't think that yours are any worse than theirs, because they're the front line.
Mm-hmm.
Although yours might be more complicated by drug addiction or other things, so I shouldn't say that too cavalierly.
Right.
So it would be very interesting to explore those differences so that you could let people know what they were,
mm-hmm.
and maybe work with them. Maybe they'd have some ideas about how to study your outcomes better, too.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
Because they've really made such an effort to do that.
Yeah, I've seen those. I wondered that myself, of what processes they used and, you know, yeah. So, yes, I completely agree.
Yeah. I mean, it's wonderful to see what you're doing. I do think the main difference in the drug use is American psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
If what you're telling me is true, that you really have a few psychiatrists that have the views, I mean, that's amazing, because American psychiatry is locked into, as a whole, much more than European psychiatry, into this drug model. You know, most of the psychiatrists I have on my radio show are from Great Britain or somewhere else. They're not from the U.S. because the U.S. Psychiatry has really gone into a complete partnership with the drug companies. And when I've been critical of them, their response to me, literally in writing, one time when I criticized them in New York Times and a letter to the editor, they wrote back that I don't understand that they have a quote ethical partnership with the drug companies. I think that British organizations would be less likely to boldly state that they have an ethical partnership with the drug companies. Probably most Europeans would be a little more shy about that. Any more thoughts about directions you're going in? We've got about 8 minutes to go. Anything more you want to tell folks about the philosophy, the orientation, where you're going?
I think where we're going in the next is that we're continuing to, I think one thing that we're doing that, you know, maybe other early psychosis programs aren't doing, or maybe they are, I'm not 100% sure about all the philosophies, but, you know, that we're continuing to integrate feedback and guidance from people who have gone, who've had these experiences. So one thing that we're very proud of in Oregon is that we've developed what we're calling the Young Adult Leadership Council, which is a group of individuals who have successfully navigated our program. You know, so we actually use the term graduate. So we say, when say graduated from our program, I should mention that we are a two-year program. And the reason why we're a two-year program is because our goal is to really help people not get stuck in this system, to kind of, you've had these experiences, and we're going to try to help you kind of move along, so to speak. Certainly not everybody is able to do that or can do that, but that's the intention. But this is a group that has, and they're our leaders. They, you know, I'm in the process right now of starting to update our own practice guidelines based on kind of new findings, based on influences such as your own and similar groups, and getting direct feedback from those people who've experienced this themselves. I mean, who better than to really kind of get guidance from than those who've experienced these symptoms and what worked for them and what didn't. And they're very vocal about that, and they're very vocal about what we did that maybe wasn't helpful as much as they are, you know, things that were helpful. So we're proud of that.
Yeah, I think that that's a very, very good quality, is to be getting feedback from the persons who have lived through the program. I would put a caveat on that, which is that if psychiatrists or other prescribers have talked them into psychiatric drugs, people who have taken psychiatric drugs aren't necessarily aware of what the drugs have done to them. And that's where I developed the concept of medication spellbinding, that people can, just like people use cocaine or alcohol or marijuana or smoke cigarettes, without appreciating what it's doing to them, and instead even worshiping the drug or believing the drug is their friend and the pusher is their best friend whom they'd never turn in, so too people on psych drugs can get very bamboozled about whether they're being helped or not. And many people will say, I couldn't have survive without my psychiatric drug. I mean, not many, but I do hear that.
Sure.
I couldn't have survived.
It would
save my life. Actually, they have no way of knowing that because they don't know what would have had to happen to them without the psych drug, in particular if they'd been offered a really good service such as yours without a psychiatric drug. They might have done much better, but they'd never know that, nor do they realize that the drug is blunting their perception of themselves and their lives, and that's any psychoactive substance they're using, including the psych drugs. They're not going to fully appreciate the blunting effect, the indifference it creates, the lack of self concern that the drugs cause. So their input about the drugs has to be looked at from a perspective that they may not know of what they speak when they say that they couldn't have done without the drugs. And some of the strongest negative responses I've gotten at conferences, especially in years past, have been from people who were using street drugs and wanted to insist on how it had saved their lives and so on. All this complicated and very interesting, and one of the aspects of this we haven't addressed is that this kind of program also relates to what we call wraparound programs. Not wraparound as in rap music, but wraparound as in wrap your arms around me. Mm-hmm. And wraparound programs basically attempt to provide all the services that an individual needs rather than give them the services that are available. So you're a psychotherapist and that's all they get. Wraparound programs try to provide people to babysit, people to help with occupational problems, people to provide a respite for the family, people to provide counseling and getting services from the community and the government and so on. They try to really meet people's needs in a broader way. I get a sense that you're a part of a wraparound tradition in that way.
Yes, yeah, we've definitely modeled our model is certainly modeled after wrap programs. Wrap and assertive community treatment programs, kind of a combo of those. But yeah, it's definitely whatever the individual needs, that it's not certainly not just psychotherapy or not just psychiatry or not just, you know, family support. It's everything. And so yeah, we really take this team approach to serving individuals, because people are, as you know, quite different and their needs are different. So that's what we want to offer that to them.
One of the things that you don't hear about, and we've only got about a minute left, I managed to scroll myself on my instant messaging, so I was off the scroll asking for a two-minute warning, and we've already been given the two-minute warning. We're talking with, and I want to have you back in a year or so, or whenever you've got more information and more learning, with Ryan Melton, M-E-L-T-O-N, and Ryan is R-Y-A-N, and he's clinical director of the EASA program, E-A-S-A, the Center for Excellence at the Portland State University. And I'm very, very glad to see you out there doing the work you're doing. I'm delighted you listen to folks like me at all. And I'm happy to have a continuing dialogue with you. Do you want to tell people where they can get in touch with you if they are interested?
Sure. For more information on EASA, please go to our website at www.easacommunity.org, and you can learn all more about us and learn how to get in touch with me.
Ryan, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on the air.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it. You have a great day.
You too. And thanks to my wonderful listeners on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.